Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Facebook shared user data with 52 tech companies, including giants such as Apple and Amazon. That's one revelation from the more than 700 pages of documents Facebook released in response to questions from Congress. The documents shed light as well on the Cambridge Analytica probe, which stems from the 2015 discovery that the Trump campaign linked Cambridge Analytica obtained data from Facebook users to create voter profiles. Investigators from Congress and across a handful of federal agencies want to know what Facebook knew about the data sharing and how the media giant can protect its users. Cristiano Lima is a technology reporter at Politico covering the latest Facebook developments. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The Washington Post reported that the FBI, the Department of Justice, Securities and Exchange Commission, Federal Trade Commission, they're all investigating Facebook. What is the common denominator in all of those investigations?
Right. So it's unclear the scope of the investigations, but clearly the fact that four agencies are now looking into the Cambridge Analytica leak speaks to the fact that these agencies are likely looking at a broad scope of potential circumstances around the controversy that has really ballooned over the past several months. You alluded to the fact that Facebook recently provided over 700 pages of answers to questions from lawmakers. So the tally of pages that they've now provided is over 1,000 in terms of responses to questions from lawmakers. So as they're currently facing questions from two chambers of Congress, to four different agencies, they're facing questions across the pond in Europe as well from regulators. So the heat is clearly not dialing down anytime soon for Facebook regarding the Cambridge controversy.
You reported that the SEC may be looking into Facebook's board, the board of directors. What is it about the board they're looking into? What do we know?
Right. So this is not something that we know. The SEC has not come out and said anything, but we spoke to one official a law enforcement veteran that said that potentially what it could mean is that it might be tied to the SEC recently strengthening its guidance on holding boards accountable for corporate cybersecurity. They might be looking to see whether Facebook has acted responsibly with respect to the Cambridge Analytica leak. But again, this is something that the SEC has declined to comment on. Mm-hmm. So we don't fully know the scope of what they're looking into.
So the FBI and the Department of Justice separately are looking into Facebook?
Yes, that's correct. We don't know the extent to which they're working together on these issues, mm-hmm. and whether they're cooperating with one another. It's unclear who exactly is taking the lead on any of these issues, but we do know that the four different agencies have reached out to Facebook with questions, and Facebook has responded to answers from them.
How would you rate Facebook's response and how it's cooperating with these investigative arms?
Right. So, well, if you have to give them some amount of credit for offering up over 1,000 pages worth of answers. You know, Zuckerberg earlier this year very famously testified on Capitol Hill. But lawmakers have still given them, for the most part, like a mixed response. Even after the latest batch of 700 pages came out, a lot of lawmakers came out and said that they thought that the answers provided created more questions than they really provided answers. So I'm hesitant to assign them a grade, but I think if you ask a lot of lawmakers on Capitol Hill, they might give them an incomplete because to a large extent, we're still relying on them to provide internal information about sort of their self-policing a lot of these issues. And that might be what has spearheaded some of these investigations by federal agencies.
Is the concern bipartisan?
Yes. Yeah. We have seen lawmakers from both sides of the aisle during the congressional testimony earlier this year. We saw that lawmakers from both sides like really grilling Facebook on a lot of these issues. It seems like there's pretty widespread concern over data security, data privacy, data collection in both chambers of Congress across party lines. This is really something that it's also ticking up at the state level, so we're really seeing as a response to backlash from voters as well. But UC lawmakers are really trying to hold these tech companies accountable, but it's an ongoing process.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about what's happening in Washington with Facebook. My guest is Cristiano Lima, technology reporter at Politico and author of the newsletter Morning Tech. If you have a question or comment about the Facebook / Cambridge Analytica issue, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The 750 pages of documents Facebook released responded to questions posed by Congress to CEO Mark Zuckerberg in April. What were the most significant revelations from the document? Was it just the depth and breadth of the data sharing?
Right. Yeah, that's definitely the biggest takeaway that came out of it. So some of this had previously been reported. There were reports about these data sharing agreements with third parties that came out earlier this year. But this was the first time Facebook came out and offered a not comprehensive, but a fuller list, a fuller accounting of those arrangements. As your show alluded to earlier, 52 hardware and software makers that were granted access to users' information. I heard the show mention, you know, Apple and Amazon, but I think of more interest to lawmakers potentially is companies like Huawei, Alibaba. So you have these Chinese
foreign countries,
that,
yeah.
Yes, correct. So you have these Chinese telecom giants that are coming under a lot of scrutiny from lawmakers and have been identified by some U.S. officials as national security threats. And lawmakers are sounding the alarm on the fact of them having access to users' information as potentially posing a national security risk. I think there's concerns about spying and whether these Chinese companies that have, to some extent, close ties to government, that they might be using that special access to their advantage and to the Chinese government's advantage.
Is there anything going on with Cambridge Analytica? They kind of closed their shop, right?
Yeah, so Cambridge Analytica has pretty much been shuttered. A lot of its members have gone on to other firms, though, and that's actually been something that's been interesting. Some of the primary key figures in Cambridge Analytica have actually started up another data firm that's performing similar functions, really. And some lawmakers are starting to ask and prod at that a little bit. And there was a letter earlier this year asking agencies to look into them as well. So it's clearly an issue that's continuing to be on the radar on Capitol Hill, and that lawmakers are very concerned about, especially going into the midterm elections, where there's a lot of fears that you'll have more issues surrounding the spread of misinformation on these platforms, that you'll have continued breaches, that you'll have more targeting of voters, some of the things we saw in 2016, that has precipitated a lot of the backlash to the Cambridge Analytica scandal.
Are they talking about regulations in connection with their concerns? Are they talking about new laws?
Yes, there are different laws that have been discussed. There's an Honest Ads Act that several lawmakers have been backing that has to do with digital privacy and transparency by these companies. But we haven't seen major steps taken at the congressional level, at least, to really address this. But you've also seen different states start to try to implement their own pieces of legislation to tackle these issues, but it's something that's ongoing, and I think there's a lot of lawmakers that are looking to make further progress on it.
The key states to make any kind of headway on this would be something like California, New York, right?
Right, yeah. So California just recently passed this sweeping online digital privacy bill that's considered likely the strongest in the country to this point, that's supposed to start providing some safeguards for users. And it's something that some other states have, they seem to be experimenting with some similar initiatives that might try to provide some protections for consumers in terms of what information tech giants can offer to third parties, like what they can make available. Some like require that tech companies allow people to opt in and opt out. Some legislation has to do with making that opt-in like more clear, like making that language more apparent to consumers, because a lot of these things, you know, we're all tied to our phones these days, but mm-hmm. You're not necessarily reading every line of these opt-in options that you might see. So these are things that lawmakers at every level are now starting to deal with. But so it'll be interesting to see how it develops going forward.
Do they make those agreements unbearably long and arcane on purpose, or are there real legal issues involved?
Right. No, that's a great question. I mean, certainly these are all very technical things that mm-hmm. There's a huge amount of legal scrutiny that these companies like put into them. But the effect of that to some extent is the fact that you have these very convoluted agreements that a lot of people might not pay attention to. So that's something that the accessibility of it, something that I think lawmakers are becoming increasingly aware of, and how do we get people to understand what exactly they're opting into, who is seeing their information, how that's impacting markets and elections and companies. And so that's definitely something that's being grappled with, but not necessarily that there has been a remedy for yet.
Are Americans safer or better protected because European countries are so much farther ahead when it comes to regulating these kinds of companies and the kind of data and how they use their data?
That's a very interesting question. I don't know that I have the answer to that. That's something, you know, Europe very recently implemented these new internet safeguards that, but the verdict is still out on those. There are a lot of people that had wished they'd gone further. There are critics of the way they were implemented. But it's unclear to the extent to which that's really protecting American consumers. You know, as we alluded to earlier in this conversation, mm-hmm. a lot of these arrangements deal with companies that are based abroad, that are operating on an international basis. So it's unclear the extent to which safeguards in Europe are going to protect Americans. It's plausible, but mm-hmm. I think lawmakers on Capitol Hill would definitely like to see some safeguards implemented in the U.S. to more directly target those issues.
How politically savvy is an internet giant like Facebook? I mean, do they donate a lot of money to candidates and politicians and committees and that kind of a thing?
Right. Well, they're very involved. A lot of these companies have fairly extensive like lobbying arms on Capitol Hill and state capitals. They have trade representative companies that represent them on issues. So, and it's definitely something that over the past 2-3 years, they've become increasingly and been forced to an extent mm-hmm. to perform those functions, because they are coming under backlash from consumers, and lawmakers are increasingly pressing them on these issues. So you're seeing them certainly gear up those standards. And we've also seen in the past year a fair number of tech companies hire positions for compliance officers. It was Uber just yesterday that hired a former Department of Justice official to be a compliance officer for them. So that's an example of a tech company that's responding to controversies about data privacy and these things by appointing someone that can sort of serve as that liaison between the government and the company that's going to try to put them into compliance with government standards.
What is your assessment of the savviness of Congress when it comes to these issues?
Right. Well, I think it's very much a mixed bag. You know, there were a lot of memes floating around when Zuckerberg did his testimony about lawmakers asking questions that that a lot of younger people could potentially answer.
Right.
So, exactly. So it's a little bit mixed. But But I think there are certainly lawmakers on Capitol Hill that are very attuned to these issues and that are the ones that are driving the charge for a lot of these more specialized bills that try to target some of the issues that we've been talking about. But it is a very large body, a legislative body. There's a wide range of opinions on these issues, and the extent to which that people understand sort of the granular level issues that these that a remedy might require is unclear, but it's somewhat of a mixed bag.
Well, Christiana Lima, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, of course. Thanks so much for having me.
Christiana Lima is a technology reporter for Politico and author of the newsletter Morning Tech. We will have more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Robots are everywhere. Now they are being used to test sewers for opioids. The idea is to target pockets of opioid abuse for ideas about treatment facilities. But there are privacy issues. Joining us right now by phone from BioBot Analytics is company president and co-founder Nusha Gailey. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
So we're talking about BioBots. What do they look like? What are we talking about? Tell us what they do.
Yeah, so at BioBot Analytics, we've built a platform in order to measure the concentration of opioids in sewage, so in wastewater, to estimate consumption in cities. This starts with a device that we've built in-house, and it's essentially an automated water sampler. So this device is suspended in a given manhole. It hangs a few feet above water level and pumps sewage through a series of membranes that are capturing the chemicals that we're interested in, so in this case, opioids, and then discarding the excess sewage. Once that cycle is completed, the devices come back to our lab where we do a chemical measurement in order to identify various opioids, so illicit drugs such as heroin, fentanyl, prescription opioids like codeine and OxyContin, as well as substitution therapies like methadone, buprenorphine, and Narcan, the overdose drug reversal.
And you can target neighborhoods. You can target blocks. I mean, how detailed can you get?
So we divide a city up into catchment areas or sampling locations that represent about tens of thousands of people. This is so that we can actually get the wastewater before the chemicals that we're interested in start to degrade. So if we are sampling at a treatment facility, which is very, very far downstream, we actually can't see a lot of the information that would be indicative of opioid consumption.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. What are you expecting this kind of testing will do to benefit communities?
Yeah, so, you know, we really see the value here for cities as really helping them assess the scope of the epidemic. Existing data that cities are using or counties or public health departments at various levels is limited to overdoses. So whether they're lethal, emergency room visits, or emergency responders, what we do know is that this data represents just a very small number of people who suffer from opioid use disorder. We actually, we see our system as being more inclusive. It's a much more democratic view of consumption in a city. It's representative of everybody. And it's much more informative to those who are planning public health interventions. So we're not just focusing on interventions for extreme users. And so that's where we set off to see, okay, you know, how can we build something that provides a lot more insight into consumption? So first, cities use this to assess the epidemic. They use it to design various public health programming and initiatives. And then finally, using this as a way to evaluate the efficacy of programming over time. So very rapidly giving feedback as to whether or not consumption is going down.
This would create a public record, right?
Yes.
Maybe I'm in a neighborhood I don't want the public to know that there are a lot of opioid abusers in my neighborhood. Maybe it brings down the value of my home, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, we see the data that we're generating a way to give voice to everyone in a city. You know, for example, my co-founder and BioBot CEO, Mariana Matus, she grew up in a poor, marginalized community in Mexico, and she really wishes that she could have been counted in government policy, that the government would have done something about the crime and pollution in her community, that, you know, her community had access to the same services as their wealthy counterparts. This inspired much of her graduate work and the scientific research, which ultimately became the foundation for BioBot Analytics. We realize that community voices need to be addressed with the work that we're doing, and we really hope to work with other organizations. I mean, we're a very young company. We've been around for 8 months. Mm-hmm. And so we do hope to work with other organizations. I mean, we have an extremely close relationship with MIT. The research for this started there. Mariana was a PhD student there, in order to build towards an ethical practice.
Joining us now is Chief Lobbyist at the ACLU of Ohio, Gary Daniels. Gary, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Ann. Always a pleasure.
What do you make of this kind of data gathering from a community? Are there any concerns, any observations you have?
Yeah, I mean, it's people bring up potential privacy concerns, and I think people out there know that the ACLU is one of the nation's foremost privacy organizations working against mass surveillance and government surveillance and all of the various ways that government and private entities track our movements, our whereabouts, our online activity, so on and so forth. But here what you're talking about is something slightly different. This might be sort of a Hitchcockian twist for the ACLU to say, look, in this case, what you're talking about is aggregate data. In a way, at least in July 2018, there's no way to trace it to individuals or individual households mm-hmm. because of the nature of sewers and the sewage system. So it appears, at least right now, unless technology gets significantly better over the years, or there's some sort of, you know, radical change to how our sewer systems work, there's not going to be that ability to track it to individuals and bring up what would be fundamental privacy concerns. Now, where this could be a concern in the future, and we completely understand that this type of technology or use of this technology is sort of in its infancy, at least in the United States, with regard to this particular use, it could still bring up mass incarceration concerns in the future. So, you know, this technology can be used to narrow down to certain neighborhoods. And so, you know, in Ohio, you know, we're still big fans of the war on drugs here in Ohio, it mm-hmm. appears, at least as far as the prosecutors and police are concerned. Mm-hmm. We keep, you know, putting a whole lot of people into our prisons, our overstuffed prisons for drug offenses. So if a local community, prosecutors, police, what have you, decided that they wanted to focus their efforts with regard to drug crime, on a particular neighborhood, and you know, let's be frank, the people who have borne the brunt of the war on drugs for decades have been communities of color, and if what they decided that they were going to do is then concentrate law enforcement resources to throw even more people in prison for drugs, that would be a concern. Now, you could put certain protections and laws in place to prevent that narrow gathering of data that is down to that kind of narrow level. But otherwise, with regard to the privacy concerns, you know, it doesn't appear again in July 2018 that there would be a way to determine if person A or household A mm-hmm. is using any sort of drugs at any sort of level.
Nusha Gailey, could it become more granular? Could it, the technology, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, be improved to target individual households?
Mm-hmm. So that's actually what makes this data so valuable, is that it is naturally aggregated and anonymized. You know, we're collecting sewage downstream from people's homes.
Right.
So by the time we get it, it's mixed in with sewage from thousands of other people. We also take a very tiny fraction of the gallons and gallons of wastewater that are flowing through a certain point in the network. So there's no way for us to pinpoint a single individual. Now, as a company, we've also established some very, very clear, values. We will not sample an area in a city that represents less than several thousand people in population.
Okay.
That's because we're using this data to help support public health initiatives, and public health operates at that aggregate level. It's not designed just to support a single household. So as a company, we are already taking steps to establish these ethical practices. And in fact, for us, it would be extremely valuable to work with an organization like the ACLU and others in order to ensure that, we're building this in a way that doesn't infringe, in the future as much as possible on any issues.
You recently pitched your service to more than 800 mayors at the United States Conference of Mayors. What kind of reaction did you get?
The reaction was very positive. So, cities are at the front lines of this epidemic, and a lot of cities don't actually have local public health departments. So it's leaving them in this situation where they're really facing the brunt of the economic and emotional burden. First responders are overworked, fatigued. You have firefighters that are spending the majority of their time, or a lot of their time, responding to overdoses. So there's this sort of call to action among municipalities and among mayors to do something about this. And so we had a lot of interest from cities. We spoke, not only on the main stage at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, but also on the Substance Abuse Task Force, where Mayor Ginther was also one of the speakers on the task force. And you can just see a lot of drive from mayors to do something and do something novel, do something innovative, and support their public health counterparts.
Gary Daniels, what do we know about, taking a technology like this and having it be misused by a city? I'm trying to think of what kind of parallel there would be out there. Maybe, I don't know, red light cameras or something like that. What do we know? Well-intended Nusha Gailey, president and co-founder of BioBot Analytics, creates this product that can aggregate really important data and help people make public policy decisions about a big problem in the United States. But can you see it being misused?
Well, it's, I've been with the ACLU for 20 years at this point, and I do our surveillance and privacy issue. I'm the person that is always offered up to the media and for speaking engagements on these types of topics. And I'll admit, for the past, 24 hours, I've struggled to find, as you say, some sort of way that this is analogous to past privacy issues, because with all kinds of technology with privacy implications, it seems the technology gets better, it gets cheaper, and it gets more prevalent. Mm-hmm. And we see with technology all the time it going down this slippery slope of what it's used for and who it's used against. So I've struggled to find some sort of a way that this type of technology, as a naturally skeptical person working for the ACLU, mm-hmm. where this might all go awry. But again, because the intention is for this to be aggregate data, and because of the nature of the sewer system and the way that sewer systems everywhere operate, again, that it wouldn't be able to go down to an individual household or an individual person with regard to privacy concerns. Maybe there's something none of us are considering right now. In 10 years down the road or 20 years down the road, this does start to enter the conversation. But right now, it doesn't appear to be a problem. And, the ACLU of Ohio, we're just as concerned about the opiate epidemic as everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so hopefully this technology, will result in some good things. But it always does make sense. And this is where cities and counties and states can be proactive if and when there is this concern to say, look, you know, we're going to use this data, we're going to use this methodology, but we're going to put some protections in place so that people don't get nervous about this, and let's be proactive about it, and let's put laws and policies in place that say we're only going to be using it for these purposes over here, and then put people's minds at rest that it won't be used or can't be used for other things, because I think a lot of the public out there quite rightly gets nervous when they hear about any kind of surveillance technology and how that might be used against them.
Nusha Gailey, what other kinds of besides opioids, are there other, do you envision this kind of technology being used to gather data, aggregate data on other kinds of consumptions, consumption of other kinds of drugs, other kinds of products, let's say steroids?
Mm-hmm. I mean, so like if we take a step back and actually think about wastewater as a collection of, you know, our urine and stool, you realize that it's actually, you know, a very, very rich source of information on human health.
Yeah.
And a very rich resource to support public health and the delivery of city services. So our vision as a company is to, you know, really continue pushing the envelope on this technology and this research to turn wastewater into a public health observatory. We imagine building an early warning system for the next infectious disease outbreak or the emergence of antibiotic resistance genes so that our healthcare providers can prepare and act rapidly. We can also measure the foods most commonly consumed in order to understand nutrition disparities across a city and exposure to environmental contaminants such as, let's say, pesticides.
Mm-hmm.
And how does all this information then come together in order to inform, you know, better urban policy, better urban planning, better health policy, and promote more livable cities? So that's really the angle and the perspective that we're coming at it as.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this work started as a research project between the Departments of Biological Engineering and Urban Studies and Planning at MIT. There was a lot of work that went into building this like interdisciplinary project. My co-founder Mariana did her PhD thesis on this work. And so, our vision for this is something that is going to exist in every sewer in America and abroad in order to really promote healthier communities.
Well, Nusha Gailey, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
That's Nusha Gailey. She is president and co-founder of BioBot Analytics. She just described to you what they want their robots to do, collect data from our sewer systems to help us identify public health problems, strengths, and weaknesses. Gary Daniels, lobbyist for ACLU Ohio, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you, too, Ann.
More Tech Tuesdays coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Russell Holley is with us now. Hi, Russell.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
We want to talk about TimeHop. It's an app that lets you see old social media posts. There was a security breach on the 4th of July of all time, of all days. User email addresses, names, phone numbers of 21 million were exposed. They say it was limited. 21 million doesn't feel limited, but what does this data breach mean for social media users? What are we talking about here?
Yeah, so, you know, a data breach like this, it really just depends on the kind of information that was put into the setup to begin with. TimeHop works by kind of recycling stuff from your older social media posts and says, you know, 3 years ago you were doing this with, you know, with certain friends, and it became more useful the more information you gave it. But the security breach in this case, you know, TimeHop didn't say exactly what percentage of its users were leaked. You know, it says it's 21 million users, which sounds like a lot, but TimeHop has been around for so long that that could only be, you know, maybe a tenth of its total user base. It wasn't really clear how all of that broke down. But according to TimeHop, you know, there was never any credit card information stored or financial information or anything like that, like IP addresses or anything. It's really just stuff that you had already put on social media and then the username and password that you used to access that. So if you used your username and password for TimeHop in other places, then you could potentially be compromised elsewhere.
Do most of us know that we're using TimeHop? I mean, I've never even heard of it before. I know Facebook pops up with these, here's what you were doing on 2014, blah, blah, blah. But is that TimeHop?
That's not. That is Facebook actually created that service in competition with TimeHop later on.
Okay.
But TimeHop is, you know, has primarily applied to Twitter users for the bulk of its traffic. And, you know, it's something that, you know, people signed up for and then probably forgot about, or, you know, it's not something that gets used, you know, kind of very actively. You are either the person who constantly uses TimeHop, in which case you have the TimeHop app on your phone and you get to see kind of your trip through time every day when it notifies you, or you get emails every once in a while from TimeHop saying, you know, this major event happened and here's where you were, you know, in time on those things. So it's likely that, you know, someone like myself who signed up for TimeHop, you know, probably 8 or 9 years ago and just hasn't really used it since the first time I went, oh, okay, this is kind of cute, and then just stopped messing with it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're the kind of person who relies on it every day for this kind of fun trip through time that you can share with your friends. There's not a whole lot of middle ground for TimeHop users.
How did it handle the breach? I mean, typical. Did we learn anything?
Well, we know that the breach happened on July 4th, and we know that TimeHop didn't disclose it to its users until yesterday, July 9th. So it had 5 days to kind of figure out what had happened and how to fix it. And according to TimeHop, once they detected and stopped the attack, it did something called deauthorizing access tokens. So the thing that was being used to access other people's accounts were kind of deactivated across all of their network, so that when you log into the TimeHop app in order to kind of reestablish a connection to Twitter and Facebook, you would have to kind of reset that up so that the people who had access no longer, or, you know, have had that access removed. But it's, outside of that information, there's not a whole lot of information about, you know, how much data was gathered and what it was used for.
Are there any regulations about how soon they have to notify people when there's been a breach?
Not in this case. It's really just, you know, working with, you know, local law enforcement officials once they start doing that to help find out, you know, who you know, performed this attack to begin with. Once you've made that disclosure to the police and it becomes public knowledge, so you kind of have to make that statement publicly as well. If someone discovers through a police report that you're doing this and you haven't made a public announcement, then that can be very, very bad for you as a company, just socially. But no, in this case, there's, you know, in the way that their end user license agreement is written, there's nothing that says that they have to come out within 12 hours or something like that.
So what should affected users do at this point?
If you are interested in continuing to use TimeHop, you have to, you know, log into the TimeHop app or go to the TimeHop website and kind of reauthorize access to Facebook and Twitter and those things. And if your email address, if your username and password for TimeHop were used elsewhere, if you you know, leaned on a password that you frequently reuse, then you're going to want to make sure that that gets changed in as many places as possible. And because this exposed email addresses to, you know, for a lot of users, it's a good idea to set up what's called two-factor authentication for your email account, which means when you log into your email account, you give it your normal password, and then it prompts you for this kind of second random password that makes it very, very hard for someone to access unless they're sitting right there with you to get that random second password.
And if you used a the TimeHop's recommending you contact your wireless carrier if you used your phone number to log into TimeHop, right?
TimeHop had an option to log in with a phone number, but it wasn't tied in strictly to your AT&T, Sprint, or Verizon account for anything like that. So it's not something you're going to have like immediate compromises. But it's possible that the phone number was used as a method of trying to access your account. Someone could call and say, "My phone number is this. My email address is this." As a way of kind of socially engineering their way into your account. So it is not impossible that that kind of attack could happen, but it is less likely than an email attack.
You wanted to talk about HTC. It makes mobile and smartphone devices. It has had a big drop in the last 2 years in sales, 62%. What does it mean? Why is this important for us to know about?
Well, this is important for two reasons. One, because I'm a smartphone nerd and I said so.
because Russell said so. Okay.
So people who follow the smartphone industry have this kind of deep appreciation for HTC as a company because they are one of the first companies to make what we consider to be the modern smartphone. The first Android phones were made by HTC, the first move into what are called 1 gigahertz smartphones, where they had, you know, processors that could actually compete on some level with desktop computers. They were made and released by HTC. This is a company that has been a part of the modern phone for longer than the iPhone, for not quite as long as the BlackBerry, but this kind of in-between period moving kind of shifting culturally away from BlackBerry as the big dominant force to Apple and Samsung being the big dominant force. HTC was in that middle ground. And over the history of this company, they have won dozens of awards over the last decade for designs for their phones and for other devices. And we actually see the influence of their design in many other manufacturers in phones that are made today. And unfortunately, they just are not as popular as Apple or as Samsung or as Google's Pixel line. And over the last couple of years, their phone sales have really suffered. The HTC One line has just not been particularly popular. And in kind of a last-ditch effort to keep the company profitable and to make some other changes to their corporate infrastructure, they actually sold a whole bunch of their smartphone business to Google to work on Pixel phones from Google to kind of continue in that direction of shaping the future of what the modern smartphone looks like. And that was expected to be this kind of big bump. This cash flow from Google was expected to kind of keep the company, afloat while they figure out what the next plan is. But it actually seems that the company has lost almost $7 billion from June of last year. Even with that cash infusion, just from a lack of market excitement.
They laid off 1,500 people from their manufacturing division earlier, or this month, I guess. What does that mean for the company moving forward? I mean, they can't make stuff if they don't have the people there to make it.
Well, they're a smartphone company. The smartphone part of their business is simply not attracting new customers. There are people who are kind of avid fans of HTC as a brand in the same way that people are, fans of Samsung and Apple and things like that. Mm-hmm. But the only truly profitable part of their industry, of their business right now, is the virtual reality side. The HTC is the manufacturer of the HTC Vive headset, the HTC Vive Pro headset, and those headsets sold very well on a commercial level. They businesses buy them to use them in amusement parks and things like that. So while not explicitly a consumer success, it has been a commercial success. And that's the only part of the business right now that is truly profitable. The phone side of it just hasn't been. So laying off these phone people is kind of a last-ditch effort to keep the other side of the company up and running.
What do you think this means for the phone business in general when you lose an early operator like HTC?
Well, we're seeing a lot of this. You know, this is not the first time that Google has invested money in a company and then seen it kind of continue to fall to the wayside. Another example is Motorola. Mm. Google actually bought Motorola's phone division, ran it for a while, and then sold it to Lenovo. And the business side of that in the U.S. is just not done very well. Motorola phones are simply not popular in the United States compared to, you know, some of these other phones. What Motorola has found has been success in Brazil and India and other places with kind of, you know, less expensive phones that target a very specific market. And so they've, you know, HTC has not competed in the same way. But we're seeing a lot of these companies that you know, were at one point kind of larger household brand names in the U.S. Ceasing to be so because Apple and Samsung in particular have established this kind of this duopolistic market dominance where you really only hear about those two brands when talking about phones that are actually commercially successful in the United States.
The trade wars, does that have any impact on HTC going forward?
It does not help because HTC does not really have the United States manufacturing setup, and they are largely a Taiwanese company. Mm-hmm. So it is the current, you know, trade situation does not help the company. But most of the retail sales for HTC phones, especially in the last year, have been online, and so the regulations are a little different than, you know, putting them on store shelves in T-Mobile stores and Verizon stores and things like that. At the same time, not having those phones on the shelves in those stores where consumers are make, you know, different demographics of people less likely to buy them.
We only have about a minute left, but I wanted to see what you think about Netflix testing new pricing tiers, a new subscription tier. What are we talking about here?
So Netflix is always kind of messing around a little bit with the pricing setup to figure out what's the best way to get people to, you know, make a purchase and stay with it. Mm-hmm. But what the last setup that we've seen is testing out a $17 a month, what they're calling an ultra subscription tier that would offer four simultaneous 4K streams. So what that means is that four different people in the house or on the account at the same time would be able to stream 4K content to television, which is a little different from the plans that exist right now. Mm-hmm. There, you know, this is a little tiny bit more expensive than a normal setup, but the difference there is that, you know, this is Netflix trying to address people who are buying more than one 4K television for their house.
Okay, well, Russell Holley, lots more to talk about next week. Thanks for joining us this week.
Thanks for having me.
That's Russell Holley, contributing editor to Android Central. Thanks for listening to Tech Tuesday today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.